I think the program has settled since I saw Tom's slides. Yes, I'll double check. Sorry, I was looking at an old version of the slides. That's okay. So let's wait a couple more minutes. We're not going. Let's do 5:03. So this, we don't want to go too late for our European friends. Oh, well, actually, friends living in Europe. I'm European as well. Yeah, sometimes I speak like an American, which is strange.
We've rubbed off on you, Raffaele.
You can hardly detect any accent at all.
True that.
Because you're underwater. Hmm?
That's Mark.
Yeah.
You know, but accent is hardly, in the United States, accent is hardly a good proxy of where the person is. Like, I've learned never to assume where a person is from based on her or his accent, because, you know, I will misclassify those people very often. That's what I did when I started. Say, hey, you're from here or there, or you're not, you American. Say, oh, I'm from Arizona or something like that.
I had the scariest experience just traveling across the United States. I was in the middle of, I don't know, mid Nebraska or Kansas or somewhere. I got out and I was in a fast food store. The young lady on the other side of the counter pegged me. She said, you're from Los Angeles, right? And all I had done was order a hamburger. She wow. heard it in my voice. She knew. She said, oh, yeah, you talk like Southern California.
Amazing. We don't get away with much in Boston either.
Okay, so I think it's... Let's get started, right? I've seen the number has basically been around 62, 63 for a minute now. So I think that we can start. Okay, so welcome everyone to the first session of the APPS, that stands for Applications Working Groups. I'm just gonna say one word about what we do. Should anyone in the audience not be familiar with what we do in terms of working groups? So I'm the vice chair. Tom is the chair of the working group. And he's giving a talk today, and that's the reason why I'm talking now. So we are focused on the software that allows users to access virtual observatory services and data. And this includes basically all kinds of things from standalone apps to things that live on the web and software libraries. I think that, well, I don't think, I know that we're also responsible for a few standards that are crucial for this task. SAMP, Simple Application Messaging Protocol, VO table definition, which is basically one of the main IVOA formats to exchange data, and in particular tabular data, and MOC, which is multi-order coverage, MAP, and HIPS, the Hierarchical Progressive Survey. And today, we're gonna have three talks. The first one from Pierre Farnik from CDS in Strasbourg is gonna talk about development in the wonderful MOC world. And then we'll have Trey Robbie, that is going to talk about Firefly. I think it's a library for web-based data archive retrieval in user interfaces. And then Tom is going to close this to talk about some VO table related issues and review and planning. So without further ado, please, Pierre, take us away. You can start sharing okay. your screen.
Okay, about this. Okay, normally you should see my slide, I hope. Perfect. I will present our effort on MOC extension. I speak on behalf of a lot of people, so editors, authors, and contributors. And just to start, I will just recall the schedule of MOC story. So we start in 2011 with the first implementation and the first ID at CDS. And the AVR decided to endorse this ID 1 year later. Still, Stopcat tried to implement some prototype. And in 2014, we have the first standard 1.0 describing mock. And thanks to this standard, there are new tools, new explorations, so mock server, Aladdin, portal, et cetera, et cetera. And in 2018, mainly thanks to the pressure of registry working group and Marcus Leitner, we tried to put mock into a VO registry. But for that, we need ASCII serialization. And it is not designed in the first standard. So we extend the standard into a 1.1 version supporting ASCII serialization. And all of this effort has been mainly driven by the application working group. And it only concerns space coverage. So 2 years ago, and thanks to another pressure from the time domain interest group, and we have tried to explore the extension of mock for supporting time definition, time coverage. So we start with the ID to reuse exactly the same ID, the same code. We develop some, we extend the library, the existing library to support time. And we have demonstrated this ID at various AVR and ADAS meeting. We have written a note, an AVR note, already presented 2 years ago. And last year, 1 year ago, at, we have a presentation of the results at ADAS. And just after the AVR meeting at Groningen, and the AVR community decided to push in this direction and to go into a MOC.2.0 standard for supporting space and time coverage. So what is MOC 2.0? It's a generalization of MOC for manipulating both space MOC, time MOC, and also the combination of both space-time MOC. And the idea that we have to follow is to support, to be fully compatible with existing standard, just an addition for supporting time convention and extension of the syntax to support the two dimension, the physical dimension, the space and the time. But contrary to the previous modification of the standard, here we need to restructure the document because the first document was oriented to Helpix. So the way that we describe the skies, the space, discretization of space. And here, as we introduce the time, the document is not well adapted for that. So we decided to change the structuration, present the principle of MOC and two derivation to implementation, one in space discretization and another in time discretization. Okay, and just for people who do not follow this story and discover the MOC, I don't know if there is a lot of people who never see the MOC. I will just present briefly some use case in the document. So the working draft published just a week ago, you will find several use cases. Mainly is always how to combine space-time coverage. Do we have observation simultaneously observed in TUMAS and HST? Do we have some catalogs having a constraint in time and space, etc., etc.? So I have a short demonstration on this big STMOC. So my colleague Thomas Bohr have tried to push the limit of STMOC and create a very big STMOC based on PanSTAR observation. He decided to select two resolution, 17 minutes in time, resolution time, and 52 arcseconds for space. And it generates a MOC. So at the end, we obtain a big file. And this big file can be loaded in tools supporting STMOC. So I will switch my Oops, no, sorry. Wait a minute. So here I have my Aladdin tools. I can load a search estimog. So here I have the estimog panstar with this big size. And my tool will be able to, thanks to the structure of the estimog, I will explain a little bit later, I will be able to move and change the constraint in time or space, so to move into the I do not see if you see my if my bandwidth is enough to see the dynamic, I hope. I can explore in space and in time all the panstar observation like this, and can zoom in the space, in the time, etc., etc. So obviously here it is estimog push at the limit. So it's a very huge estimog. Generally it is smaller. So I will just load two other estimog pre-compute. So the Chandra estimog and the XMM there, and Chandra there. Okay, and now I will switch off the panstar, and normally I can explore, and for example, I will do just an intersection between these two estimog to find the space-time region coverage by both missions. And I will just do that like this. Intersection creates, oops, and it finds a new one with some objects, some region, sorry, not some object. Wait a minute, I zoom. Effectively, I have one time elements and one space element corresponding somewhere there. So this is the end of the demonstration. Now I will come back to my presentation and explore the document, the working draft published recently. There. Yeah, also on use case, we see that there is an expectation from other community to use estimog. So as we have already presented several times this kind of use cases, typically the LIGO Virgo community is already using MOG for describing gravitational wave credible region. And he would like to add the time extension to manipulate both space and time for this kind of region. So three use case. Now come back to the document. 1 year ago at Groningen, we decided to go in this extension, time extension. We need editors, authors, and so I have to thank my colleagues Adam Ebot and Daniel Durand to help me for the editions, and all other authors. So the original authors who have accepted to continue this story, and some new contributors from CDS. And the result is the working draft published last week, and you can download or find on the IVO site. So the document presents, as I said, the MOG principles, discretization, unique referential, hierarchical system, unique representation, and serialization. This is the four pillars of a MOG. And we keep the same principle that spatial MOG follows. So a MOG is just a list of number. It do not manage geometry. It do not manage except it just manage a list of numbers, and to reduce the size of the numbers, we have a mechanism to group together consecutive cells used by observation. So we have this kind of representation like this, order the list of numbers, order the list of numbers. This is the principle of MOG. And we have just to extend this principle to time. So we need a discretization system, so it's not LPX, and we have choose GD, discretization, based on 1 microsecond cells. We need a unique reference. We have decided to follow TCB reference. And by this way, we are able to address 73,000 years at 1 microsecond resolution from GD equals zero in a long integer. This is the convention that we have followed. So we have a convention for space, we have a convention for time. Now, how we can combine both of these dimensions. So the idea already presented in the note 1 year ago, it's to interleave element of time, element of space, et cetera, et cetera. So by this way, we are able to present HTMOC exactly as I have presented in my demonstration. So the document now, the working draft, mainly we have start from the note, but there are several change from the note. The first one is the factors between several orders in time. We have decided to choose a factor of 2. I will explain just in the next slide. Also, we have introduced the range mechanism for the serialization, and we have introduced a new section in the document explaining the usage and some constraints on the usage of MOC. So, first point, the factor. So we have order, the pyramid of the order. In LPX, the factor is 4. Between each order, we group the cells 4 by 4. And in the previous demonstration that I have and other colleagues have done, we have reused exactly the same code. So it means that we keep the factor 4. And the goal is to have very fast implementation. And that's why we have already some implementation available. But it's not very natural to reuse LPX 4 factors. In fact, because time is just one dimension, and we can use the 2 factors rather than 4. So it means that we have more orders and it is more natural. So we have decided to, for the time, the order is factor 2 by factor 2. The other modification from the note is the serialization. So as I have explained at the beginning of my demonstration, MOC is a hierarchical representation of cells, but also we can express this same list of cells based on range notations. And for people who have implemented MOC, generally, internally, it is a range notation which are used in the code. Not totally, it's not always true, but very often. So typically here in my slide, I show you a representation in hierarchical notation and the equivalence in range notation. But both are exactly the same equivalent for describing the list of cells. And the third modification in a new section, MOC usage constraints, we want to emphasize some point for the usage of MOC. The first one is the canonical form to express how it is important to have a unique representation for a unique coverage, to have a fast operation, so creation, union, intersection. So some constraints will be applied for that. So the cells should be short, well grouped, et cetera, et cetera. The second point is we have emphasized the importance of the choice of the resolution. So a MOC can be defined at any kind of resolutions. It's your decision when you create a MOC to more or less, when you take a picture, you decide which resolution you want. It is the same thing for a MOC. If you want to load in Aladdin, if you want to put in a VO registry, it's not the same usage, it's not the same resolution. So you choose the resolution and you get a certain volume for the MOC. So it's always an upper coverage approximation, and I refer to the use case. And the third point is an important point when you have to manage and to work with MOC with not the same resolution. So typically you have one MOC with at a resolution of order 10 and other at order 12, and you want to combine to do a union and intersection. So MOC has been designed for observation coverage. So it means that all cells contain at least one observation. And if you want to keep all cells property, so all cells with one observation, it means that you need to work at the worst resolutions. So in the document, it is explained with a short schema to understand why we have to do that. And if you want to manipulate mock just for surface manipulation, so in this case, you can use and you have to use the best resolution. So this section has been introduced in the new document to explain these two kinds of usage. Now, the SMOC serialization. So as I said, we reuse the same binary fit stable serialization, the same material that we have introduced in MOC 1.1.0. But we have decided to use the range encoding way. And we interleave the time coverage item, so the time coverage range, with their associated space coverage. And the last bit, the 33 bits, is used to distinguish the space indices and the time indices. So at the end, a space-time mock is just a binary table with a succession of long integer describing time cells, space cells, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In the document, there still have some debate on fit keywords. So we have to choose what kind of fit keyword we have to put to describe the characteristic of the mock. And the first characteristic is a mock order, the resolution. And we have started to follow, to keep the compatibility with previous mock. So mock order keywords and mock order underlying one for the other dimension. But after the discussion, we are proposing a new notation, mock order underlying S for space and T for time. So it's clearly oriented and more easier to implement it. Well, more easier, I don't know. Another point is for the reference systems. In the document, we fix a unique reference system for coordinate and for time. It is equatorial and DCB. And presently, in the current set, in the draft, it is explicit. So the keyword is explicit in the header. And some authors say it's not an obligation as it is described in the standard. So another proposition is to remove these two keywords, but there is some problem for the coaxes because it's a long story, but coaxes comes from the helix, and if we do not have coaxes, it's by default galactic and et cetera. So we have to discuss a little bit on that. Another possibility is to keep the coaxes, but do not provide the timesys. Well, it's a discussion, and I suppose that we can continue this discussion in the working group. So the next step, and it is my last slide, we are waiting your feedback on the current working draft. So please read it, try to understand or implement, why not? We have to adapt the two already existing implementation to MOC.0. Mainly due to the change of the factor 4 to 2, and it's mainly for myself, for Aladdin. And the idea is to be ready for an RFC period before the next interop, I hope. And also parallelly to explore and to push this idea, we would like to generate more STMOC. We have already a large collection of STMOC, but we have to convert in the MOC 2.0 standards and generate new STMOC from Vizier, from IPS, or from VO provider, why not? And the idea is to ingest in the CDS MOC server first. It's a good example. And at the end, for people using, for example, Aladdin, you will have a discovery tree, not only managed by space, but also by time. And at the end, I have mentioned a big question of my colleagues who wants to explore tips. It's an idea to extend time mock. If we compare, we have mock and hips, and we can do the same thing with tmock and tips to have a way to access not only for the coverage of time, but for value for a time series. But just ideas, and to be explored. So I have to finish my talk with many thanks to all editors, authors, and contributors. It's a long story, long debate, and I have time now for questions, feedback, and comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pierre. That's wonderful work. And Mark shows all its flexibility and versatility. So let's open the floor for questions. So I will ask everyone to raise their hands with a little Zoom thingy. Let's start with Francois. That was the first one to go ahead.
Yes, in the previous session, we had a discussion about the idea of extending MOC and STMOC to energy, to spectral axis. I know there was plans about that, but what's the current status? Because apparently there is really a demand from the radio and astronomy group on that.
In the MOC 2.0, clearly we just described space and time for MOC, but we have keep all the extension possible. So you will see in the document that we do not close the door for third dimension for energy. But at this time, we would like to achieve the MOC.2.0 document. And if we want to extend to energy, I think we have to restart a new cycle, because we have to find a good convention to describe all the energy dimensions. It's not easy because it's not linear. It's we have to put in 64 bits all the possible coverage. And we have long discussion about that, starting with our colleagues, and we have decided to not stop the effort on MOC.0, time and space, and keep this discussion for another cycle more reasonable.
Okay, thanks. Gregory, you're next.
Two questions, and they're kind of related. So you mentioned wanting to go back and regenerate MOCs for existing HIPS maps. Will the adoption of MOC 2.0 also be, do you want to fold that into the HIPS recommendation? I mean, because in a way, HIPS requires a MOC.fits, right, to be there. Maybe it doesn't require it, but it's certainly strongly recommended, and all of the HIPSGen ones have such a MOC.
I think, in fact, it is already available in HIPSGen with a hidden parameter. So you can generate your ST MOC, but presently not in the HIPS standards. And I think, I don't know, if it should be a recommended not, just to add this possibility, because it's a very good thing to have the STMOC besides the HIPS. Start again all the process of the standard for adding just this point on HIPS, it's a little bit heavy, I think. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think just from a formal perspective, it would be nice if we had to agree as a community that we were going to allow MOC 2.0 in a standards conformant HIPS, I think, because we have a lot of tools now that look at HIPS. You know, it's a pretty substantial ecosystem. Okay. So a related question, and here I wish I had the time to go look this up before asking a potentially stupid question. You were mentioning the coordinate system. So HIPS, of course, can be generated in multiple coordinate systems. There are HIPS in galactic, there are HIPS in planetary coordinate systems for the, you know, coordinate systems on planetary bodies. If you standardized to only equatorial for MOC, that wouldn't fit very well with HIPS anymore, right?
You're totally right, and it is one point I have not mentioned for coaxes. Presently, we push to have only one system for celestial observation. Mm-hmm. So EquatorEdge, the idea is to have an easy way to compare, to combine.
Yeah, obviously but you benefit tremendously.
Yeah. If we go out typically for planets, obviously we have to reintroduce the coexis with Mars, Jupiter, or this kind of referential. You're right. And I think we have to think, and certainly with our colleagues from planets, to define MOC for planets, for one planet. For the time, well, it's more universal. I do not imagine some case that we have to support several times, but perhaps, I don't know, it's always difficult to close the door in this kind of thing. So my position, I would like to prefer to let coexis and time cis in the header with a fixed value, and perhaps in the future we will have to open a door to another system.
That would be my sense as well of what's appropriate. I'm gonna let other people ask questions. I do have one more, but I don't want to monopolize the time.
So is there anyone who wants to ask a question before Gregory? Ask a third one? Well, let's go to Serge. Serge, please.
So I was just wondering if you had thought about reserving extra bits in the indices for the energy dimensions. So right now you're using the top bit to distinguish between space and time. Would it make sense to maybe reserve two so that you can add extra things there without?
We have reserved two. In fact, if you look, we have 62 order in time to keep the two last bits. And in fact, we can merge together four dimensions. But again, we do not have prototype this kind of things, and we can have a problem of combination, too many cells to manipulate. And I have been surprised that we can manipulate space-time as I have demonstrated with Pan-STAR. But if we introduce a third dimension, perhaps that will be too big and we cannot manage. I don't know. But in any case, we have keep a bit for energy, sure, typically.
Thank you.
So we have a couple more minutes, actually three. So Gregory, please go ahead. You have a question, if no one else.
Yeah, so my other question is kind of all around discoverability of MOCs. I think it's quite possible that the Rubin Observatory will generate a large number of MOCs. Representing different aspects of its data set. And we don't have an agreed upon IVOA level standard for registering metadata about MOCs.
No, you're right. I think.
And the MOC server is your thing. It's admirable, but it's not standardized, right? And so that's something that in this working group, I would like to explore maybe in conjunction with the working groups that deal more with discoverability with registry.
Normally it should be hosted in a VEO registry, I suppose, yeah. But presently it is only oriented with a very rough definition in ASCII with a very bad accuracy. Maybe we can have a link to the deepest resolution of this kind of thing. But again, it's just a coverage for a resource, and perhaps the MOC could be a resource itself without.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm thinking of, and I'm trying to go a little deeper here. So there's a session that I'm leading. I've got to look up the UTC time here in order to be fair to everybody. At 20:30 on Thursday, so for so that towards the end of the, it's the last session in the, before the closeouts, in which I'm going to be talking about trying to do some standardization for handling file-oriented catalog data. So we now have very, very large catalog data sets, tens of billions or even more entries that will be served for bulk download or other kind of access in things like Parquet files. Mm-hmm. And typically they will be in hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of files to shard that data. And there are, you could think of this as something that could be handled by OBSCORE to provide some metadata that tells you the coverage of the sharded bits. But it turns out that there are some widely used sharding conventions that don't have compact spatial coverage. for which a mock is a much better model than an STCS region, which is what's in OBSCore. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try to trigger a discussion about using mocks to document coverage for things in a possible future extension to OBSCore. I just wanted to flag that up in this session so that people would see the connection. So I'm not going to discuss it further right now, but this is a potentially very interesting topic, and ST mock makes it all the more interesting in some respects.
Great. Thank you, Gregory. That's a great link and it's very appropriate. So most of us will be at the other session Thursday. Okay, so let's move on. Thanks again, Pierre, for your talk, and let's move to Trey Robbie. Trey, please, you can start screen sharing your screen.
Okay, I'm sharing it now.
Great. So.
Okay. You can. Well, thank you. So I want to talk about Firefly support for service descriptors. So the idea is we've been implementing VO standards for two or three years now. And we started with HIPS, and then we implemented some basic mock support, and then added TAP and OBSCore and partial data link with S region support. But this fall we started adding full service descriptor support. So this talk, I really wanted to talk about what we've done briefly and give you a brief demo, and then talk about things we've observed and challenges we've had with implementing service descriptors, and maybe what we could, some suggestions that we might want to consider putting in the standard down the road. So mostly the purpose of this is to give feedback and experience in implementing service descriptors. So let me go to the demo. So I've downloaded using our in Firefly we have a TAP search. I've done two searches. I've done a CADC, and I've done a mass search, and that's returned two different tables that have actually, they've already been loaded. They take a minute or two to load, so I wanted to go ahead and preload them for the demo. And just to give you a sense of what they're covering, it's a pretty big area around M31. And I want to talk about the differences and what we had to do to support, ultimately how we had to support service descriptors. So, but first to really understand what we were doing with service descriptors, it might be good just to start with the mass search, which is just a simple OBSCore. It's not service descriptors. It's not data link, but it represents what we have to do to get to data link and service descriptors. Because ultimately, to do stuff like this, you have to be able to take the data in and analyze it. So a big part of us supporting any of this stuff has been this file analyzer we've written. So ultimately we're downloading files as the user clicks around and figuring out exactly what they are. For example, this one I'm showing here is a FITS file with two tables in it. And then we want to give the user the option to show either of the tables, and then show one, the one that can be shown as a chart, show it as a chart or table. And so when we're getting to this sort of data, virtually every data product we're loading can be almost anything. So we're having to be able to analyze the data as it comes across. Well, like I said, this first search I did was a simple OBSCore search with no data link. So let's go to the CADC result, which is more complex for us. It's it has a data link in it, and it has service descriptors. So if you look at this more dialogue dropdown, you can see everything that this search result is returning. That's the this product, and it has a couple of previews, but we're having to analyze each one of these to know, well, that's a fits or that's a table, or that's a VO table. And so I started here, but I want to show something even more complex. So this is where it gets really interesting, because when you hit a service descriptor for this data product, you have all this stuff that it will return, and then each file will have all the different things that might be in it. So I have this, the primary product has 5 HDUs, and then it may have a couple of PNG files. And then there may be an auxiliary product with a table. And sometimes these can have multiple HDUs in them. So we're having to hit this thing and then handle all this data coming back. Now, what makes this, so I said I'm gonna talk about service descriptors. So So once you add service descriptors to the mix, then you have to start worrying about getting input from the user. And I'm going to demonstrate getting the input from the user here. I'm going to show you how it can fail, because this particular one fails, but I need it to show this for the rest of my talk. So I hit the service descriptor, ask it to load the cutout, and it fails. And honestly, I don't know why it's failing. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit down the road. But I can keep going through these. I have data products I can do. Some of them are service descriptors. The only difference from the user's perspective is the service descriptors are going to require input. Okay, now I'm going to do another search here. This time I'm going to load a ZDF product from the from URSA. Now, recently Judith is going to give a talk about this. She added service descriptors into some of the data products that URSA is producing. So this search is fairly fast. So it shouldn't take long. So I'm coming back with a data product, and each one of these lines have, this data product has one service descriptor. And so it can load the light curve, and I'm getting what it does directly from the service descriptor. So I can take any line and then load the light curve table directly from it. Now, what's really cool about this is Firefly has no idea what it's getting. It's just completely driven by the service descriptors and metadata. But as I got into this, I was thinking we can really take this even farther. So I downloaded this VO table from the service descriptor, and I added a new service descriptor to it. So it already had one service descriptor. So I created another file with just this one particular search result of yet another service descriptor that I'm going to upload. And what this service descriptor, it's exactly like the other file, but this service descriptor that I'm uploading takes the original service descriptor and wraps it around a Firefly call. So now instead of loading a data product, I'm actually going to launch another web application. So since I have two service descriptors, I have my more dialogue here. I have my original one that will just give me the table, but I also have the second one, which will then, when I click this, it will take, it'll wrap that thing in a call to Firefly. And this is completely driven by the service descriptor. So Firefly has a time series viewer, and what this says was launch the Firefly time series viewer with this data. So I can then, I'm taking it to the next level. Not only can I see the data, but the service descriptors give me a suggestion on how I can view it. So I can go to any of these tables and launch the Firefly service descriptor of each one. So that concludes the demo part. And let me go back to the talk. So I want to in the time remaining, I basically want to talk about what we learned from doing all this. So the great part of this is the spec is easy to implement. VO tables are easy to edit and try stuff out. You know, we have existing services to try with CADC and IRSA's new services. And it's just clear to us that data link and service descriptors have tremendous potential. Service descriptors, as I demonstrated on those last two files, where you just have a data product that just has a service descriptor attached to it, kind of independently of data link, has huge upsides for homogeneous data. Okay, so let me talk about a few challenges. One, I talked a lot about we have to analyze the data, but the and there's a couple of others, but the biggest challenge for me is knowing for a service descriptor what's a optional and what's a required parameter. And something we might want to consider adding it to the spec. We have all these parameters in a potential, all these parameters in the service descriptor. It's just no, it's not clear being able to say, well, what do I need input from the user? What do I have to have input from the user for? The other thing is when you start using service descriptors apart from data link. Now, I don't know if service descriptors were ever intended to be used apart from data link as in the original spec, but they're going to be because they're very, they have just huge upsides. So the problem with doing it though is data link provides all this information like content time, content length, and semantics that aren't in the service descriptor when you use it standalone. Now, some of this stuff we can figure out by downloading file, but stuff like semantics, that would just be a really nice thing to have inside the service descriptor spec. And description, if you don't happen to use the description tag in the service descriptor, which is not in the spec, I don't think, as a requirement, then you have no way how to title it. So I personally think we should just throw all the stuff that's in data link into the service descriptor as well.
Hey, 1 minute.
Probably my biggest challenge was how to format the URLs, and particularly for things like arrays. And it just was, there's just no way to know. And the failure I showed in my demo is because I really ultimately think it's because I don't know how to format the URL. There's just not enough information in the param. So I would like to see an example in every service descriptor of how to call it. So one last thing is the spec doesn't give us any clear way to know whether a service descriptor is referencing a data product or an app. And so the way we figured that out is we download it, the HTML file. Well, we download the product, we discover it's an HTML file by the content type, and then we decide it's an app, then we launch it. So that's a lot of work. It'd be nice if the service constructor could say, this is an app, launch it, and not a data product. So anyway, the last thing is I have no idea whether we implement this correctly. It'd be really nice to have a simple server validation suite. And we can talk about this in more detail some other time, but it'd be nice to know, have a way to prove to myself that we did implement correctly. So I think there's huge potential in all this. And I'm loving the fact that we can do these things in Firefly without having to know anything about the data. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Trey. Very interesting. So we have time for just one quick question, and Francois raised his hand. So Francois, please.
Yes. I have an answer for Rob. Service descriptor was from the start intended to be used also outside data link query response. So it's true. And some of the addition you require coming from the data link fields to be included inside the service descriptor, this has already been proposed, and there is a new version coming out where some of the stuff will be there. And maybe you can come to the meeting on Thursday. We have a data link 1.1 status on Thursday at 1:30 UTC.
Okay, I was actually planning on being there. Yeah, the idea of being able to tell the difference between an app and an HTML and an optional parameter and a required parameter, I think, are probably some of the more important things I mentioned. Yeah. Having a title too is big.
And having, having the semantics there would be just tremendously useful.
Yeah.
Okay, great. This seems like another topic that will be discussed more and more in next sessions. That's good. We're talking to each other. Okay, thanks a lot again, Trey, and let's move on to Tom, who's going to talk us about developments in the view table world.
All right. Thanks, Rafael. Thanks, everybody. So we've talked a little bit about some of the documents this group maintains, and view table is another one. So I wanted to go through the current status of that and see what work is to come. Let's see. There we go. So just overview for reset everybody. The VO table standard, the format for the interchange of tabular data, it was the first version was approved way back in 2003. It is heavily used. We see it a lot. Trey just mentioned it a lot. It handles the results of most DAO protocols. Reading and often writing of VO tables is supported by many, many applications. Mentioned the AstroPy platform includes native mapping to and from their AstroPy tables. I mentioned that because that's sort of one of the main community software accesses to VO table. The last time we released a new version was this time last year. It was version 1.4, and the main purpose was to support the new TimeSys element to help with time domain data results. During the discussion of rolling out that new version, several issues and discussions were essentially deferred so that we could expedite the support for TimeSys. Another development since then is that now VO table has been converted to an Ivoa text document. It's a updated form of LaTeX that was developed at Gavo, I believe, and is now being used for many, many of the IVOA standards. And it's being maintained in GitHub at that URL. The idea with the GitHub is to have as open as possible a development process for these documents and a development process that is familiar to some who do open development type work. But we also recognize that there's a learning curve to using GitHub and participating in that process. So I list here a few resources for learning more about Ivoa Tech. Is also on GitHub and has a nice README there with pointers to some other documentation on how to get started with the actual nuts and bolts of the document itself. As well as the GitHub process was presented this time last year in Groningen. And in May, we had a hands-on exercise where we got to practice some of the document lifecycle. I have the links there to the presentation and notes, and also the video recording, which I'm a little self-conscious about, but you can feel free to watch that as well. Okay, now instead of maintaining sort of ad hoc lists of items or trying to mine the email threads for issues that people raised, we'll be tracking issues about VioTable in GitHub itself. And I just show the GitHub page there that lists 13 open issues currently for VO table. Notice over there on the right is the button to file a new issue. And I encourage everyone who has any sort of concern with VO tables to file issues there. GitHub offers nice support for discussing each of these in its own context. Okay, now I'm going to go through, I don't have that much time, but I'm going to give you an idea of the sorts of issues that are out there. Four or five of the issues I classified as sort of asking for new features. That first one, issue number 16, QSIS should have a ref position attribute. This is a request for a subtle but advocated as such in the email lists where this came up originally. I have a column over there on the left, and it's describing whether or not fixing the issue would require a major revision version. In other words, do we need to leap to VO table 2.0 in order to solve this particular issue? The answer for that one is no. For some of these others, I wasn't sure, so I'm not going to make that determination. But basically, the main requirement for a minor revision is that it should not break existing clients. So if Trey's code is properly reading VO tables in Firefly, according to the 1.4 spec, and we release a 1.5 spec, Trey's code should be able to process documents that conform to the 1.5 spec without crashing. Of course, it wouldn't recognize any aspects to it, but it should also not break because the structure has changed too much. A number of the issues involve just sort of fixes, clarifications, housekeeping of one kind or another. And you know, you can go and look at the details of these. Some of them, well, only one of them here requires a major revision. That's issue 23, and making QSIS and TimeSIS more consistent. These two elements were rolled out during different VO table versions, and the TimeSIS was being the most recent, sort of polishes the attributes a little more the way we wanted. And so while they really accomplish sort of parallel things, they do them subtly differently, making it somewhat confusing. Unfortunately, to address those in a way that makes them robustly consistent would require a major revision change. So that likely won't happen super soon. But a number of these are potentially very simple fixes. And I think we'll find it, well, I'll just not go into these details. Okay, are there issues lurking out there with VO table? Well, yes, of course there are. Some of them might be nagging operational issues that are just not mentioned on GitHub. You know, you may have been complaining for the last 4 years about something in VO table, and you forget to bring it up at the interop meetings, and you haven't sent out an email on the email list. Well, the thing to do now, right after this session, is to go ahead and submit that issue. If you have a big idea about VO tables, maybe a new VO DML mapping proposal, or JSON support, or removing multi-table support, or I don't know, it could be anything. Doesn't have to be something you think will be widely received, but the idea is that submitting an issue makes it easy to track and not forget. Similar discussions can be completed in GitHub. That's probably the case with 90% of the issues we just looked at. For more complex discussions, maybe we proceed, maybe we have a one-off telecon to discuss a particular issue that's complex. Or maybe we can complete it on the email list where it might be a little easier to express more complex ideas. I mentioned here that the relationship between GitHub and email discussion, we don't really know exactly where all these conversations will happen, but let's see how it goes. I think it would be nice to have notifications of GitHub discussions appear in the mailing list. Okay. So the next, this is where I'm asking you all questions. Would the next VO table version be major or a minor revision? Well, we saw that most of the issues can be addressed with a minor revision. And of the three current issues that may require a major revision, none to me seemed critical enough, but obviously I'm open to other opinions on that. So my assessment is that the next version should be a minor version, and that would be version 1.5. So when should we do that? Well, really, in this GitHub process, changes can happen at any time. Somebody, one of you, could submit a pull request tomorrow that addresses one of these issues, or brings up a new issue and addresses a fix, and people could review that pull request and it would get merged and then would be automatically included in the next official working draft that we roll out. If we set a target date for an official version 1.5 working draft, then we could just include any changes that are merged to the master branch prior to that date. Setting a date may actually encourage work on at least the simpler issues. Now, if we only get one small change, maybe that makes it in before the date, then having all the overhead of a new 1.5 release may not be worth it. But I think in sort of a more agile mentality, by having more frequent releases, we can resist the urge to wait for every possible change to be polished perfectly before we release the next version. We can feel free to release with just a few changes, knowing that with a quick release cycle, actually release more, your change could make it into the next version. You won't have to wait that long. Okay. So this is just sort of guidance, maybe read offline, but the idea is moving forward, really encourage everyone to participate in this process, subscribe to the mailing lists. You can subscribe to GitHub notifications, and there's lots of ways to do that, described at that link there. A couple of Slack channels, one for this group and one for GitHub help in general. File issues in GitHub for when you know of things that should be fixed. Fix things, submit pull requests, and reach out for help, whether it's on Slack, the email list, direct email to any of us, GitHub comments. And that's it. Thank you very much. I kind of asked for your feedback on whether people would favor setting a date in the relatively near future for freezing development on 1.5 and trying to roll it out, maybe even by the next interrupt. What do people think? Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. So let's field a couple of questions, and then we have, for everything else, we have so many channels to communicate and keep talking about this. So Gregory, please go ahead.
Yeah, this is actually directly related to the previous talk. The service descriptors in Datalink 1.0 were a little bit of a forced marriage with VO table params, and some of the concerns about them, you know, come from the fact that they've been overloaded onto params that originally had a different intent. So I would just ask that we be conscious of that connection as we work on 1.5 and or 2.0 and think about like where to go next with Datalink, with the service descriptors, whether to preserve that overloading or whether to strike out in a new, more semantically driven way is something I think people have been talking about a little bit.
That's a great point. It's potentially a great example of where it may be worth filing an issue that's not really proposing a solution, but maybe just a placeholder for something that we shouldn't forget to discuss.
I think we can
bring in the DAL group and so on involved in those discussions.
I think we can for sure do that after the DAL 3 session, after we've had the Datalink conversation. I think it would be really natural to file an issue summarizing the implications.
Yeah. Excellent.
Good. Francois, the very last question.
No, it's just a comment on what Gregory proposed. I think in principle, it would be good to refurbish together VO table and Datalink. But there is a drawback to that immediately, is that Datalink 1.1 is almost ready and have a lot of changes in. So if we do that now, we will delay Datalink. So probably this will be for a major revision of both protocols together later.
Yeah, that might be the right answer. I don't, not arguing with that.
So more on, more on that maybe Thursday.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't see any other raised hands or comments. So Marco, okay, there's a comment in the chat that you can read. Anyway, so at this point, let's wrap this up. I want to thank all the speakers. It's been very interesting. And I want to remind everyone that we have another apps session coming up tomorrow at 3 p.m. UTC, 15 UTC. So you do the math and it will be very interesting. So thanks a lot, everyone. And let's keep the conversation going. Thank you. Have a good whatever time of the day you are in.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.